welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast, continuing with Northern Heights, climbing North America's highest peaks. We are ready for Chapter 11, To the Crown, King Peak, 1999. Here we go. Jennifer and I had become enamored with each other on Sanford, and we started bagging Colorado peaks together. In 1997, my good friends Stan Havlik and Gary Neptune invited me on an expedition to 26,362-foot Gasherbrum II in the Karakoram, and I immediately said yes. The climb was a fundraiser and ultimately raised over $10,000 for the Colorado Cancer Foundation. I knew that to round out my global mountain experience, I needed to see the Karakoram, which from photos I knew to be quite different from the Himalaya. I invited Jennifer to live in my house while I was gone. When I returned, we would carry on. In January 1997, as a warm-up climb for Gasherbrum, I went to Argentina to climb Aconcagua for the second time with Chris Holland and friends. We went up the Polish glacier route. It was a fine climb, and the 22,834-foot summit of Aconcagua was the highest summit that Chris and I would share. The summer of 1997 was consumed with the climb of Gasherbrum II. The Karakoram was indeed a new experience. Compared to the Himalaya, the Karakoram Mountains are more rough-cut. Jagged fangs leapt toward the sky at every turn. As the climb progressed, letters from home arrived every week by runner. As the recipient names were read, my name appeared several times, while others hung their heads when their name was not read. My letters were all from Jennifer, and they were love letters. I devoured them. The climb progressed well, and I summited with Stan's son Eric on a stunning clear day. Eric and I spent 3 hours on the summit together, reveling in the views. We joked that in that time we could have climbed onto the summit of K2. Oh, wait! K2 was over there. In the end, 10 members of our Gasherbrum expedition made the summit all without Sherpas or supplemental oxygen. Near the end of our summit climbs, the famous Russian climber Anatoly Bukhariev shared our permit and made a successful dash for the summit. I gave Anatoly a drink from my water bottle on his descent, but had no idea that he would be dead 5 months later. The climb was a howling success, and Jennifer's letters had hit their mark. Jennifer and I married on Valentine's Day in 1998, and she became Jennifer Roach. We immediately started bagging peaks all over the western U.S. Chris Holland and Sarah Ballantyne were renting our basement during this time, and I had ample conversations with Chris about climbing. I showed him photos from Logan and told him that he needed to explore the great peaks of the St. Elias Range, a place that he had not been. In particular, my famous photo of King Peak from my 1973 Logan expedition caught Chris's eye. Hearing the siren call, Chris and I planned an expedition to King Peak for 1999. King Peak, like Hunter, was on my long list of difficult peaks that I was not sure I could ever climb. I bought sharp new crampons and fancy modern ice climbing tools. We formed a team of six. Strongman Tim Haig of Hunter fame was an obvious choice. I had another friend, Kevin Frederick, from work, who was a master rock climber, and he signed on. Another strong Colorado climber and superb alpinist, Mike Butane, was also quick to sign on. Ket McSparren rounded out our strong team of six. King Peak has no easy route. We planned to climb King Peak's long west ridge. We knew that this ridge had difficulties up high, but felt that it was our best chance on this tough peak. We would fly into the normal landing spot for Logan at the base of King Trench. Flying in, we flew around the west side of King Peak, trying to decide if we should approach the west ridge from the north or the south. I now had a bald spot on the top of my head, and my beard was almost solid gray. The view from the plain of King's West Ridge made me suck wind, and I wondered what I had gotten myself into. Yes, we had technical difficulties to worry about on this climb, but our biggest concern was bad weather. With technical pitches on summit day, the famous storms of this area could easily shut us down. They could also trap us on the ridge and make descent both difficult and dangerous. However, the salient feature of this trip that we did not yet understand when we flew in with perfect weather was that a large high-pressure system would get stuck in the Gulf of Alaska for, count 'em, 8 days. In this land of low pressure, the probability of such an event is near zero, but it happened. We reached the West Ridge from the north via a steep but smooth slope, and up we went. With boots on the snow, the lower ridge didn't seem so bad. We were committed to an alpine-style ascent where we would not ferry loads. Every careful step with our full packs brought us closer to the summit. We made good progress on the first day and reached a suitable camp spot. We discussed whether we could reach the summit from this camp, but Hunter had taught us a lesson about too long summit days. Tim blurted it out succinctly, "We need another camp." On day two up the ridge, our fourth day of good weather, we overcame the remaining difficulties on the lower ridge to reach a site where we had a sobering view of the summit. This would be high camp. We had carried our full packs far enough. Taking full advantage of the good weather, we prepared carefully for our summit climb. Launching early on summit day, June 9, we quickly dispatched the cornest but easy stretch of ridge between camp and the upper mountain. We climbed as three ropes of two. Finally, on steeper slopes, we chunked up with two tools to reach the base of a short rock pitch. This turned into a belayed pitch. I was climbing with Mike Butane, who continuously demonstrated his great skill on this terrain. Chris was leading the group, and I was last in line of our procession. I collected any hardware left on the route and hustled to get it back up to Chris, who was charging ahead with gusto. When Chris radioed back saying that he was ready to lead the upper crux pitch and needed the gear I was carrying, Mike and I poured it on to get the gear up to the front. Lo, by the time we reached the base of the crux pitch, Chris, the master, had already led the pitch. All we could do was watch the others follow his brilliant lead. It took a while to get all six of us up the crux pitch. I was last, and when I reached the exposed Class 5.7 rock section, the others above hollered that I had to wait while they better organized the upper stance and anchor. I spent many minutes poised in my precarious position, and these turned out to be pivotal minutes. I looked down and saw a universe of air tugging at my heels. I scanned the horizon. The amazing weather was still perfect. I looked ahead and studied the rock that I still had to climb to reach the top of King Peak. It looked hard in rock shoes. How was I going to climb it in crampons? It was devoid of any big holds. I did see a small handhold high on the little face. Then I spotted a small horizontal crack at waist height. I carefully rehearsed my move sequence in my mind. I took off my big mittens and clipped them to my harness. I would need bare hands for these moves. When the rope above me came tight and I heard Mike's loud cry of, "On belay, Jerry!" I put my plan into action. With a side press against the protrusion on my left, I moved up and got the front points of my right crampon jammed into the small horizontal crack. Perfect! I matched my front point jam with my left front points, straightened, reached up, grabbed the small upper handhold, made another left press, scrabbled my right crampon on the bare rock above, reached up and grabbed a big hold at the top of the sequence. With a shout, I was up. Quickly moving up to the belay stance, I wondered if the pitch had been easier with crampons, since my front points fit right into that little crack? That was a question I would never be able to answer. Now it was time to hustle up to my long-sought summit. Mike and I moved up to a tiny alcove and were surprised that the others had already summited and returned to this alcove to fire up a stove to produce some much-needed water. That left Mike and I free to summit just the two of us. Chris said that we didn't need a rope to summit, and that he needed our rope to rig the big rappel over the crux. So Mike and I unroped and started up the King's Crown that I had dreamed about. It was one of my most memorable finishes to a high summit. From the summit, Mike and I scanned across the mighty south face of Mount Logan. I had returned yet another gaze. After this intoxicating summit, Mike and I returned to find the rappel over the crux already set up, and our descent accelerated. Lower, we chose a variation to our up route that avoided the first rock step. We descended a couloir down the upper north face, then traversed west to regain the west ridge. This otherwise avalanche-prone option was only possible because the weather had been perfect for days and the snow was in stable condition. After more careful steps, we were back in camp enjoying a stunning sunset. In the amazing alpenglow, I gazed south at Mount St. Elias, knowing full well that it was now my only remaining peak to finish my lifetime quest to climb North America's 10 highest peaks. The longer I stared, the more improbable it seemed. King Peak had been a dream climb, helped by a clear air mass that didn't move. Was that a kiss from God or just global warming? I now had enough experience with northern storms to know that St. Elias could not be so easy. My goal still seemed a million miles away. I was getting older and the peaks were still hard. Back in Yakutat on the coast, we gathered to munch salmon burgers and chose a table near a window facing a still clear view of St. Elias. Then I wandered the coastline and discovered a spot where I saw Mount Logan. I was not aware that Logan was visible from the coast, but there it was. The lack of clouds was key. The next day, as we boarded our flight home, I paused by the plane door and looked back at the still clear St. Elias. Like an Everest, it sang to me. As we flew away, the stunning range rose to our eyes, and the song rose to join the amazing 10th movement in my Northern Mountain Symphony. Stay tuned for Chapter 12 from Northern Heights. Nice catch, St. Elias 2000.